The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Patrick Jenkins. Joining me in the studio today are Brooke Masters, our Chief Regulation Correspondent, Daniel Schaefer, Investment Banking Correspondent, and Jenny Thompson, our Retail Banking Correspondent. And down the line from Dubai, we have Camilla Hall, our Gulf Correspondent. This week, we'll discuss the replacement of the scandal-plagued LIBOR benchmark rate, which could happen as soon as next year. We'll take a look at news that a prominent member of the Saudi royal family is at the heart of a US criminal probe into whether Barclays made improper payments in the kingdom. And finally, we'll discuss the financial well-being of the Co-op Bank as Moody's downgrades the bank's credit to junk status. First, though, to the LIBOR story. Brooke, never a week seems to go by without you writing something about LIBOR. And the latest is you've been talking to Martin Wheatley, the head of the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK, who has responsibility for overhauling the regulation of the LIBOR benchmark. Interesting comments that he made, really, about wanting to have a dual track system going forward. Can you explain?
Martin's point of view is that if it is not possible to design a new benchmark that is based on market transactions that will run and act very much like the one it replaces, that it is not fair to existing contract holders to just stop the current rate, which is based on surveys, and start with a new one.
Because just to rewind a little bit on this, LIBOR, as we all know, or as many people know, is the benchmark that has obviously been brought into disrepute over the manipulation of the benchmark as regulators have investigated it over recent years. But it's hugely important. It underpins $350 trillion of contracts around the world in various forms. And those are long-running contracts in many cases. So even if you think you want to rip up LIBOR and start again, you can't because you've got these ongoing contracts that need some kind of benchmark.
Well, what's interesting is there are two perspectives on that. And some regulators, Gary Gensler is the most prominent, think that, in fact, we do need to rip it up and start again. And he wants a relatively short transition period because he believes that the existing rate, which is based on banks' estimates of what they can borrow at, is basically fiction. Because at this point, banks don't do unsecured lending to each other, so they're making up estimates.
So is Gary Gensler, specifically, he's the head of the CFTC in the U.S. Does he summarize the U.S. position? Does he represent it?
Well, he got the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is all the U.S. regulators, to sign on to a recommendation, I think it was last week, for prompt replacement and saying that the current rate was unsustainable. So that definitely, the U.S. is clearly in that camp.
So how would that work in practice then? What would happen to legacy LIBOR pegged contracts?
That's what's not clear. And that's what Martin's concern is we need something. I think the growing consensus is that at least for some period of time, you'll have to run rates in parallel. There'll be a new market-based rate and there'll be a survey rate. And I think the fight will ultimately be over how long. I mean, it should be noted that the Bank of Spain is still running a MIBOR, which is a Madrid rate, 13 years after there stopped being any interbank lending in Madrid at all because they have 30-year mortgages that are tied to it.
Right.
I think the U.S. regulators would view that as a failure. I mean, they want something to end much sooner.
And everyone's agreed that they want forward business from here on to be related to actual transactions rather than some survey rate, as you say.
I think ideally, one of the things that people have raised is that transaction-based rates are much more volatile than survey-based rates. They tend to bounce up and down a lot. And what that may mean is it makes things like variable mortgages and variable student loans far less attractive. I think that's a price that some regulators are willing to pay, but not necessarily others. And so that's the other half of this fight is what exactly do you do with all those new variable mortgages as well as old ones?
And what is the likely consequence of that going forward? Is it that we have far more fixed rate lending in future, a move in the UK towards a more of a continental European model or a US model?
It's hard to tell, actually, because the other thing you could do, and the Bank for International Settlements has raised this, is that regulators could develop a rate that they want to steer everybody to that is stable, yet also not manipulable.
Right.
And so the Bank for International Settlement, which working on a project basically put forward by the UK, said that's another possibility, is that we come up with a better rate and sort of steer people into it.
There's also one element that you have to consider is that moving to transaction on the benchmark rate doesn't necessarily mean that it's not prone to manipulation. Because if it is a market that doesn't have a lot of liquidity in it, you can have manipulation in there as well. By making up transactions or by putting orders into a market, small orders that can influence a price if it's small liquidity in the market.
Yeah.
That's particularly a problem when the market is over the counter. So there isn't an easy way to check whether these are small orders that nobody knows about.
Right.
And that's come up. IOSCO, which is the global group, the International Organization of Securities Commissions, which is also trying to come up with solutions, not just for LIBOR, but also for, you know, gold benchmarks, oil benchmarks, et cetera. One of their concerns is over the counter transactions and how to handle them.
Final word, in this hugely complex evolution of the way things are done, what's the next thing to look out for?
They'll pick a new LIBOR administrator to run the UK rates. They're doing shortlist interviews, I think, next month. So within a couple of months, that administrator is then supposed to put forward some concrete proposals as to what to do next.
Right. Thank you for that, Brooke. We should move on to our second topic, which is Barclays in Saudi Arabia. Daniel, this has been a long-running story. We, I think, reported a few months ago that Barclays was under investigation over its various activities in Saudi. In particular, there was a Department of Justice investigation in the US that we wrote about, which we thought centered on the granting of a license to Barclays. But in the last few days, we've found out far more details about this. Bring us up to date exactly.
The main thing really that has come to light now and that we reported on over the weekend is that the US Department of Justice is probing whether a prominent member of the Saudi royal family has been involved in this through illicit fees that were paid to him by Barclays.
There are two separate instances that seem to be under investigation as well, rather than just one.
Yeah, one incident was connected to attempts by the bank to recover a large loan on which a borrower had defaulted on more than 10 years ago, which was for a loan given for a large building project for...
This military compound.
Yeah.
And the suggestion there that investigators are looking at is whether this Saudi royal, whose name is Prince Turki bin Abdullah bin Abdulaziz, a son of the king, whether he had been the recipient of improper payments from Barclays to try and recoup those funds from
that loan. Yeah.
And then there was a second incident as well, which was related, as we'd originally reported, to the license that Barclays got a few years
later. Yeah, Barclays doesn't dispute that it had worked with Prince Turki, but it Barclays saying that they had appointed him to advise it on strategic issues, as he said, in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, as well as on the license application.
Right.
So they're basically saying we did work with him, but there wasn't any illicit element in it.
Right. And we should say that a representative of Prince Turki, albeit tangentially, has indicated that the relationship has been between Barclays and Al Obayeh, which is a company that Prince Turki is involved with, rather than with him as an individual. It's all very complicated stuff, but obviously harmful, again, I suppose, for Barclays' reputation. We've got Camilla Hall on the line as well, our Gulf correspondent, who will know far more, if not about the intricacies of this specific investigation, certainly about the ways of doing business in that part of the world. Camilla, do you think this tells a broader story?
I think it does raise questions about introductory payments, about the whole idea of middlemen in Gulf banking. I think, as you said, you know, Barclays have confirmed that they worked with Prince Turki. You know, the question really remains in this story as to whether did they really need his help? What was he able to provide them? What did they feel that they needed from Prince Turki that actually would warrant hiring him? I think it does raise a broader question. If international investment banks think that they need support from these third parties, is it really the case that they do, or is there a perception that they do within the kingdom? I think talking to some sources, there are questions over whether Barclays really needed to hire someone to actually help them facilitate the license with the CMA, or whether they would have been able to receive a license alongside many other investment banks that actually got their licenses around that time. So I think it does raise broader questions. I think one of the other interesting things about this story is really, you know, what did Barclays get out of this license? I think there's big questions as to how much money can actually be made by the big investment banks in Saudi Arabia. a lot of them went in at the same time, but who's actually been successful?
Yes, it's not such a big market that there's actually room for everybody to prosper.
Well, the irony is it is a big market. I mean, it's the biggest Arab economy. It's a huge market, but it's how do you make a profit there? Part of the issue is that you have extremely liquid local banks who are willing to lend, who already have the relationships with the best clients. And one of the problems in Saudi is that everyone wants to lend to the same clients, whether it's Aramco or, you know, your big government state companies. So how do the international investment banks come in and lend to those clients who are already well catered for by the local banks? How do they differentiate themselves? And some people talk about the failures and the successes of certain banks within the kingdom. And Deutsche Bank is an example that comes up as a bank that has actually done quite well in the kingdom because they've been able to go in there with balance sheet. And they've gone into some of the largest syndicated loan deals. And they've been able to offer that kind of secondary market in a way that perhaps the local banks hadn't been able to do. So they'd offered something unique and tried to differentiate themselves. Whereas when you see some of the other investment banks going in, not really wanting to lend, I think they find it very difficult to get on to some of the advisory deals. The bottom line in the Gulf has been, you know, you have to go in with balance sheets. Otherwise, you can't really expect to do business here.
Right.
And I think different banks have behaved differently. The very, very top notch, you know, US banks have always tried to lend to the top clients, but it's a very competitive market and the local banks are already doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Daniel, for Barclays, what does this latest turn of events mean in terms of, obviously, as Camilla's saying, it might not be a hugely lucrative market for them to be able to generate earnings from. But I'm guessing that for Anthony Jenkins, the chief executive, who's basically on a mission to try and clean up the group's reputation, this news of the latest investigative details is the last thing he needs.
The main thing I think really it shows is that the legacy of Barclays will continue to haunt the bank for many years to come, really. The strategy that Anthony Jenkins announced, which is to transform, as he called it, the bank and make it a culturally and socially more acceptable bank and with you know, better business behavior, is really not a three-year project as he set it out to be, but it looks more like a decade-long project.
Yeah.
To transform the culture of a bank is very difficult. And he's been starting last summer, and since then he had to deal with still some of the LIBOR issues in connection with the LIBOR rate manipulation scandal. He had to deal with the PPI and interest rate protection scandals, mis-selling scandals, and he's still having to deal with several legacy legal issues, such as the Saudi investigation, as well as the investigation into the cash calls Barclays did in 2008, where Qatar was one of the investors.
Of course, that's another Middle Eastern connection that, as you say, will be haunting him, I'm sure, as investigations proceed on that over the coming months. We should leave it there and move on to our third topic, which is the Co-op Bank. There's been some fairly dramatic developments of the Co-op of late. Last week we saw a fairly severe downgrade from Moody's of the bank's credit rating, and also the chief executive resigned. Jenny, you've been looking at this story. Where does it go from here?
It's all a bit up in the air for the Cooperative Bank at the moment. I mean, it's worth saying that they have issued a statement saying they're not looking for government support, which was one suggestion the Moody's report raised. And in some ways, it changes relatively little. Of course, the big news from the bank has been the collapse of this sort of big transformative deal, which was going to something like triple it in size. This was the deal to acquire about 600 branches from Lloyds. So in that sense, there's nothing new. The question now is, where does the bank go from here?
So we found out a few weeks ago, when the Lloyds transaction was still a possibility, that regulators, we understood at least, had discovered a capital deficit at the bank of up to £1 billion. Even though that deal has fallen apart, the question remains for the Co-op is how they are going to raise that capital. They don't have access to equity markets like listed banks. How can a mutual solve this kind of problem?
Yeah, well, they have limited room for manoeuvre. I mean, they can't tap their shareholders for cash. They do have some subordinated debt. But of course, you know, the question now is not issuing more, but, you know, what's going to happen to the holders of that debt? I mean, we're in a state of limbo at the moment to some extent. I mean, it's not clear exactly how big the capital hole might be. Obviously, they've got a new chief executive in. So against this backdrop of them having to review, you know, what their plan to, you address the whole is going to be. There's also, you know, a kind of a breath of fresh air by Ewan Sutherland, who's been in the job for about a week now. So it's unclear what it might be. I mean, the most obvious route would be making disposals. They've already announced or made the disposal of a couple of insurance businesses. And of course, you know, the co-op is a fairly sprawling group. It's sort of fairly common to say, you know, nothing is sacred. I think it would be shocked to see, you know, the supermarket division rapidly reduced. But then, you know, there are other areas such as, you know, funeral businesses and pet care and things like that. The other question really is what's going to happen to the underperforming parts of the bank? Because of course, you know, the bank, it just as with RBS and Lloyds, it's sort of a tale of two entities. What's dragging the co-op down at the minute are the bad loans it acquired when it took on Britannia and these underperforming commercial real estate loans. The bank already designates these as non-core, but of course that raises the possibility, would they run down that book, which they're already doing? Would they sell it off? Would they hive it off in some other way?
Brooke, you have obviously taken interest in this story from the regulatory capital point of view. One of the reasons we think that this capital deficit has emerged really is because the Bank of England's Financial Policy Committee conducted this study a few months ago of the capital position of all the banks. Where is that whole process at? Because they've basically handed the reins to the Prudential Regulation Authority, which is the new prudential regulator within the bank. Where are we at in terms of that process?
We're not entirely sure when, but we do know that the PRA will be announcing sometime in the near future, you know, what it expects all the banks to do.
Do we think that's going to be a public exercise? Are they going to say X, Y, Z bank has to raise certain amount, or is it going to be left up to the banks?
It's not yet clear. I think their preferred position would be that they tell the banks and then the banks announce it themselves. If there's recalcitrance, there might be a public announcement. But I think the preference is for the banks to announce their own problem and own solution in their own time.
Well, I think the key for the co-op is probably whether the number that comes out of that exercise tallies with what they can hope to raise from asset sales, and also the time frame that they have to do that. Because it's not clear what the time frame is for meeting any capital deficits, right?
The last thing the FPC said when it said it wanted all this stuff fixed, they gave a sense of end of the year, but it wasn't a firm like, we will do this by January 2014. What's interesting about all this is the commercial real estate stuff is just disastrous on many of the bank's books. And it's emerged first with co-op, but it will be interesting to see how bad it is elsewhere.
Yeah, quite. Well, that's it for this week. All that's left for me to do is to thank Brooke, Daniel, Jennifer, and down the line, Camilla, for their contributions, and to thank you for listening. Remember, you can keep up to date with all of the latest banking stories at ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Katie Carney. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost £27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.